Today we move along with the topic that is without question one of the hardest in dental histology, not so much because of the difficulty of the structure per se, but because of the three-dimensional thinking that you must bring to it to understand some of the structural features of enamel. As we already discussed yesterday, enamel is the most highly mineralized tissue of the body. It has 96% by weight mineral and only about 1% by weight of proteins, and the remainder is water. So this is an extremely highly mineralized structure, and we already saw yesterday also that the basic units of this tissue are the enamel prisms or enamel rods. So you have a series of enamel prisms, each surrounded by an organic prism sheath, and no cells. There are no cells associated with this particular tissue. Now, there are a series of characteristics to the tissue that you are responsible for. Some of them are similar to what you saw in dentin, and so you are going to depend on some of the knowledge that you already gained on that tissue, and some that are strictly and uniquely associated with enamel itself. So let me begin now. Can you get all your tables set so that I don't hear all the flapping and clapping going on? Thank you. That's fine. And now let's go forward with the structure. Now, there are a series of structural features in enamel that we are going to talk about, and some of these structural features are grouped together. The grouping that we have is shown here. I find that some of the better ways of dealing with it. And so we have three groups of structural features. One is associated with the dentinoenamel junction, and those features are all near the dentinoenamel junction. They are known as spindles. So the structures that you see here in brown are the ones that are actually the structures that we're going to look at. Then there are the sequelae of the appositional growth process, and that's where your knowledge of dentin comes in handy. We have cross striations, we have striae of Retzius, and then something unique for enamel that is known as perichymata. Cross striations are diurnal, and the other striae of Retzius are structures that are associated with severe stresses to the organisms. And perichymata, as I said, are unique, and we'll come to that in a little while. And then there are a third group of features, and the third group of features is associated with the pathways that the prisms take. As we discussed yesterday, enamel prisms, while they are running perpendicular to the tangent of the surface of enamel, nevertheless, as they are running toward that surface, they are not running straight, but they are running a sinusoidal curve. And because of the fact that they are arranged as a sinusoidal curve, there are unique structures that are visible: tufts, lamellae, Hunter-Schrager bands, and gnarled enamel. And so that is the project for today. We are looking at those features, and we'll try to make an understanding of it. Let's first begin with the DEJ. The dentinoenamel junction, of course, forms at the site where you have a basal lamina, between the dental papilla and the inner enamel epithelium. As you know, the inner enamel epithelium is going to become the ameloblast, and some of the cells of the dental papilla are becoming the odontoblast, and these two groups of cells are moving out of the way as they lay down the dentin and the enamel, and clearly then the site of the DEJ becomes is the past site of the basal lamina. So that is something that you already know. Now, the basal lamina is a fairly straight structure. And so the boundary between the enamel organ and the dental papilla initially is a very smooth surface. But by the time we are getting into the first deposition of dentin and the interactions with the pre-ameloblast that lead to the formation and the differentiation, rather, of the ameloblast themselves, there is, as you know, a very active interaction between cell processes from the dentopapilla, the odontoblastic cell processes, and also cell processes from the pre-ameloblast. There is a free exchange of odontoblastic processes across what used to be the basal lamina, but now is being broken down. The basal lamina is no longer intact at this stage. And so that is a period of tremendous change in the morphology of this site. And so by the time you come to the first dentin and enamel deposition, what used to be straight as a basal lamina here, now is, right from the beginning, going to be a scalloped surface. And this scalloped surface has its concave sides facing to the enamel, while its convex sides are facing towards the dentin. So there is no difference. It's always that way. And when you look at the dimensions, you see here the dentinal tubules, and the dentinal tubules will give you a very good idea of dimensions. Essentially, we're talking about 2 to 4 micrometers thick in this area. And so if you see that dimension, you would immediately appreciate the fact that there are multiple enamel prisms that are associated to a concavity of that dentino-enamel junction. So that gives you kind of a sense of dimension in this structure. So then you now look at a fully formed tooth, and you do that usually in ground section, you see a dentino-enamel junction which is scalloped. And the scalloping is quite clearly seen here. There are different layers of focus, and so that's why you see sometimes scallops here at a different layer of focus and different point. But the main principle comes through. You see these scallopings of the dentino-enamel junction very clearly here. And it is variable. Some teeth have an enormous amount of scalloping, especially the third molars in the permanent dentition. Other teeth have less scalloping, but it is in the crown. It is not in the root, in this dentino-enamel junction, not the dentino-cementum junction that is scalloped. So that is something that occurs literally at the time when the basal lamina is broken down and you're just beginning to form the hard tissues. Because by the time you have the hard tissues forming, you, in a sense, fix that dentino-enamel junction. Yeah? This is the dentin, yes. No, it's really at the interface. The line is at the interface. Now, that's an interesting point. Let's now look and see what happens. Because, in fact, there are structures that cross that line. The dentino-enamel junction, which is the true boundary between the dentin and the enamel, is crossed by one series of structures, and these are known as spindles. And spindles are really very short extensions of dentinal tubules that cross the dentino-enamel junction. Here's the dentino-enamel junction. Here's a spindle going across. And this is an extension of the dentinal tubule. The lumen of the dentinal tubule continues into the enamel. It may be a simple shape, like the one I just show you here, or it may, in fact, be a somewhat more fanciful shape like this, like a club. And it is this particular shape that has given the name spindle to it. That's a morphologic description. Now, what are we looking at here? First of all, I want you to see that the enamel prisms in this particular section run in this direction. So the spindles have absolutely no relationship to the cores of the enamel prisms. They are little structures by themselves. How did they form? Well, they formed at a time that I just illustrated for you, and that was here. Here is a long cell extension of an odontoblastic process, and now when the epithelial cells start forming enamel. They form the enamel around this little extension, and that extension kind of gets stuck. Okay? And so this is truly what you're seeing here. The enamel spindles, while they are found in the enamel, really are extensions of the dental tubule, where the final tip of the odontoblastic process literally cuts surrounded by the forming enamel. There is no functional reason to their existence that we know of, but that is not necessarily going to be so 10 years from now. So we observe it, we say there are these spindles. Most of the time, when we do transmission electron micrographs, the spindles are empty. So they have a little empty lumen, and there's no odontoblastic process. But then, as you know, the odontoblastic processes frequently are not seen in the dental tubules either, because they shrink. So we don't really know if these odontoblastic processes actually fill these spindles or not. But there is very limited reason for them to, that we know of, that they exist. Now, not many of these spindles are present. Spindles can be present in largest numbers in the area around the cusp. So around the cusp of a, for example, a molar tooth, you find generally a lot of spindles. And frequently that is also the area where most of the dental tubules have nerve fibers present inside the tubules. Whether those two facts are related or not, they are coincidental, I think, but that is something that we observe. So if you want to look for spindles, you look at it at a ground section of a tooth, and you look for it near the cusps of molar teeth. But you can find them anywhere. And here you see another one, typical spindle shape, and here's kind of a simple one. You know, the hard thing that you have to do is when you are looking at a structure like this, you have to actually decide whether the dental enamel junction in this location is in focus with the tubule and the spindle. Because of the thickness of the ground section, it can be literally so thick that you can have an oblique overlap of the dental enamel junction over the spindles, or in fact the reverse can be present as well, and it may look as if the structures cross the dental enamel junction, but it's just a result of the way the section is made. So you have to see at the same time a dental enamel junction and the crossing of the tubule into the enamel to make the absolute decision that you're looking at a spindle. Don't call everything that seems to be going across into the enamel a spindle, because they're not all necessarily there. But here there is no question. Here is the picture of all pictures, prevalent location of spindles, and you're seeing here these really large spindles sticking out. You see there are only a couple of micrometers, but these are closer to 40, 50 micrometers. So this is a pretty huge structure in this case. So spindles here around that cusp, very well shown. So that is the DEJ and the spindle. Yes, question. It's not possible to say it from these sections, because they can look the same way either way. But in this case here, it is a longitudinal section. I can look at it because I see the Hunter-Schrager bands. Okay? So this is a section which is part of the cuspal region. In this case here, we don't know. Okay? And there is, so you can see them either way. You can see them in a longitudinal section. You can see them in a transverse section. Was another question there somewhere? No. Yes?
Does that mean, you said that spindles are most often found by cusp and incisive region?
Yeah.
Does that mean that you'll never, will that, you ever see anything on the side of spindles?
Like, oh, no, no, no. You can find them anywhere in the crown. Okay. Anywhere in the crown enamel can you find them. But they are more, if you really want to be sure to find one, you look near the cusp. Okay? But you can find them anywhere in the enamel. Okay, So that is the first one. The first one is relatively simple. DEJ scalloped spindle crossing, which is an extension of the dentinal tubule. Now let's go for the serious stuff. The serious stuff is striae retias with the corresponding structure of the perichymata and cross striations. These correspond with, in the case of dentin, the contour lines of Owen. While the cross striations correspond with the imbrication lines of von Ebner. Okay? Those are the correlates. So, if you find a particularly strong contour line of Owen in the dentin, you may look in the enamel to find a corresponding striae of retias in the enamel. That is a reasonable thing to expect. Let's now look. Okay, and this is how they look. Actually, the striae of retias are much more beautifully visible in the case of enamel because they stand out stronger. This is a striae of retias. This is a striae of retias. Now, you will notice that some of these striae in the earliest formed enamel go all the way around the cusp. And that is an area of enamel that we have called appositional enamel. So the appositional enamel is the first formed enamel, typically formed around the cusp or around the incisal edge, where the striae of retias are continuous and going all the way around from their point where they start obliquely at the DEJ all the way to where they end obliquely at the DEJ at this point. But they go all the way around. Later, when this part of the tooth has been completed, we now have only segments, line segments that are formed. And so the striae of retias now are going from the DEJ to some point on the outer surface of the enamel. Okay? So they don't go all the way around and stay inside the enamel. Once you have that, once these peripheral lines are becoming line segments, and that is something that really makes the difference, we now call it imbricational enamel. And as we will see, the imbricational enamel has very regular striae of retias, while the ones in the appositional enamel are very much haphazard. They form when there is a stressor. So there are two different kinds of lines that we find. In a very beautiful image of one of my colleagues in the physical anthropology field, you can see how the appositional enamel separates out from the enamel that is formed by imbricational apposition, and that is shown here. This is the first point where the enamel is completed at this point at the tip of the cusp, and after that, a group of ameloblasts will retire. And that's something that you have to consider. Remember, the first ameloblasts to differentiate were right here in this area near the cusp. And as they are laying down the enamel, they become the first cells to retire. When they have retired, that particular area of enamel now has reached its full thickness. And generally, a group of ameloblasts retires when there is a major stressor, when there is a period in which the enamel is formation is interrupted, a striae of retias sets up, and now what happens is after that stressing event, the cells between these two arrows stop. They're no longer going to continue, but the cells immediately cervical from them continue to form more enamel. And what is the effect? Well, the effect is that at the boundary between the cells that have retired and the cells that go on, that boundary will become a little depression. Okay? And that will happen again and again as more and more cells retire. You're seeing it here. There's a depression here. There's a depression here. They are not all very clear because they have been worn down a little bit, but in general, when a group of ameloblasts retires, there's a stria of Retzi is formed there, and when the next group of cells continues on with enamel formation, this point, this area here becomes a groove, a little deep point. Now let's first talk about the striae of Retzius in appositional enamel. Like the contour lines of Owen, pay attention, like the contour lines of Owen, they are hypomineralized. Again, these are isochronous surfaces. These are surfaces that were formed at one particular time when the organismal stress was occurring, and when that temporary interruption of enamel formation occurred and the mineralization wasn't perfect. And so when you look at a scanning EM image of a section through the enamel, you typically find that you have, as a result of the demineralization, you find here a slight depression in the tissue itself. That just indicates that it is easier demineralized and therefore there was less mineral to start with. So it's a hypomineralized surface, and that is shown here as lines in sections. But in the imbricational enamel, what I just showed you was appositional. But in the imbricational enamel, there is something very different going on. The Retzius striae look the same. They are hypomineralized, but they are very, very regular. The regularity, you see it here. This is one, two, three. You can see them one after the other, like clockwork. They come in. And in fact, if in a scanning electron micrograph, what you're seeing here, again, this is a SEM of a section, what you're noticing here is that these lines, the Retzius lines are these ones, these oblique lines. The prisms are going in the direction of the arrow that you see next to the image. And you notice that these lines are pretty much the same distance apart from each other. There is a regularity, something that indicates that there is a cycle. And this particular cycle seems to be about 7 to 9 days. Nobody really understands the nature of the length of this cycle, the same way that we really don't understand why imbrication lines of von Ebner get particularly strong every 5 days. I mean, that those cycles are at this point not clear to us. But what we do know is that when you reach the end of one of those cycles, there is a slight deviation of the enamel prism. It doesn't go straight through. You see it here. Here is the prism, high power, and here is the prism before the line. And you notice that there was a little shift. It was almost as if the ameloblasts were kind of drifting a little bit, and then they took off again in the straight path that they were taking before. So these striae of Retzius in this imbricational enamel are areas where there is hypomineralization, no doubt about that. But there is also a zigzag kind of pattern of the prisms, which of course reflects the zigzag pattern of the ameloblast when they were laying it down. So this is something very interesting and very peculiar. If you didn't ask me, but I'm going to tell you anyway, the reason for these little events, I think, okay, that is remains to be proven, but it is a good working hypothesis, is that when you have a group of ameloblasts here that comes to a certain point when you form a Retzius line, they may be a little stressed because these ameloblasts, they go from a narrower surface to a wider surface. And there comes a point where they may be a little stretched and they stop for a while. And then the next group of cells comes in. They make a little adjustment in the pattern of their course, and then they go a little bit further, and then they stop. And then here again, there is a little adjustment in the pattern, and the cells can continue on a little bit further. So one explanation, one possible explanation, and it really is open for any and all, is that what you're having here is a regular pattern of a little stress produced by the spatial relationship of these cells. They readjust their alignment, and they continue on for a little while until the next crisis occurs. But these retches striae are exceptionally regular, and they are, as I said, characterized by the fact that they are hypomineralized and that they show a different reorientation of the path that the prisms take. These are not due to a kid being sick or a kid being born or something like that. They simply are too regular and too straightforward. Now, the way the enamel the striae of retches are aligned in the enamel is very much based on the way you cut the enamel. In a longitudinal section, as you see on the left here in this picture, the retches lines all run from a point at the dental enamel junction outwards. Either they run directly to the surface of the enamel, or they run outwards to go around the incisal edge in this case, and they go back to the dental enamel junction. But the point is that in a longitudinal section, the retches lines cross at some point. They don't completely cross, but they hit the dental enamel junction. Okay, they literally reach the dental enamel junction in a longitudinal section. In a transverse section of a tooth, on the other hand, if you just imagine that you make a transverse section, the retches lines run parallel to the DEJ about the same distance. So in the case of a transverse section, as you can see here, they are concentric lines, while over here they are oblique, running to the DEJ. Okay? That is the difference that you see. And it has other results. As you know, the enamel prisms were running at right angles to the tangent of the surface. And that means that in the case of striae of retches, they do not cross at right angles with the prisms. They cross at some different angle with the prisms. The prisms are going this direction, along with the blue arrow. The retches striae are going this direction, so there is an oblique relationship. The striae of retches are crossing at an angle, usually less, if you go in the cuspal end, than 90 degrees relative to the course of the enamel prisms. In the case of the transverse section, on the other hand, the right retches striae are perfectly perpendicular to the enamel prisms. So those relationships are easy to understand, and you see it very nicely. Now, here is a transverse section through a tooth. It shows several other things, but if you look at the retches lines, this one here, this one here, this one here, they are all running more or less concentric. It's not 100% perfect. This is a biologic structure, so don't expect perfection in a mathematical sense. But what you find is that the striae of retches in this transverse section are running in concentric circles, parallel to the DEJ and perpendicular to the course of the prism. So if these are the striae, the prisms are going like this, okay? So that's very nice. You see some other really neat things here. For those of you that are already understanding your dentin, all of these structures right here at the interface between the outer third and the middle third of the dentin, those are interglobular dentin areas. Are there lots of them? In some teeth there are. Are they normal? Yes, probably they are. Okay, so these are the striae of retches. And of course, in the same way as the contour line of Owen, if you have a primary tooth or a first permanent molar, you may find a unique striae of retches, which is a neonatal line. And people have measured the width of that striae of retches and have found that the harder the birth process was, the wider that line of retches is. If you are born by cesarean, the line is extremely narrow. Usually, normal birth, uncomplicated, it's about 12 micrometers in thickness is what you find. All right. Now we come to the second of the sequelae of the appositional pattern, and those are the perikimata. Now that's a Greek word, and it is something that literally means, peri means around, and the kimata is a wave-like pattern that you see at the periphery of the tooth running around the surface of the tooth. Now let's give it a definition. Perikimata are the external manifestations of the striae of Retzius. So, in the imbrication enamel, and only in the imbrication enamel, whenever a striae of Retzius hits the surface of the enamel and makes this little depression, this little groove, that's what you call part of the perikimata. You have the perikimata are grooves alternating with bulges. The perikimata, therefore, can be found here, 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 but they are mostly lost as a result of wear, and so you can really see perikimata best in a newly erupted tooth. Here it is. Let me just see if we... look at the one to the right. And if you're looking in this area here, you see these little ribs, little... structures. Those are perikimata. So again, just understand that perikimata is a combination of two phenomena, grooves and ridges. Okay? They together form the perikimata, grooves and ridges. The grooves are the external manifestation of the retzius striae. That's where the retzius striae come to the surface. The ridges are the enamel that formed in between the two striae. And that's what you're seeing here. Here is a striae of Retzius. Here is one. And here is the next. These are these imbricational striae, very irregular. And when you look here, there is a groove. And this is the ridge. And here's the next groove. And here is the next ridge. Okay? And that's what you're seeing here. This is a newly erupted incisor tooth, and you can see these striae of Retzius rather nicely. This one shows it also. This is a premolar, but it shows it better if you do a scanning EM of the surface of the tooth. And now what you're seeing here, these are the grooves, and these are the ridges in between. So ridge, groove, okay? And essentially, I want you to remember how they form. What happened was the ameloblasts that were over here, more occlusal, stopped secretion together with the ones that were more cervical, the ameloblasts more cervical. But then after this period of interruption, these ameloblasts continued to go further, and so they formed essentially a little bulge, while the previous cells did not. So the ridges are formed because there's continued activity of the more cervical ameloblasts. Now here is an example of a perikimata in a tooth that is of a slightly older age. And you see it here, quite beautiful. These are, they literally are like little wave-like phenomena at the surface of the tooth. If you can get Dr. Yuan to talk about it, that was the topic of his PhD thesis, and he actually studied the perikimata in a variety of ethnic groups to see what the difference was and how the thickness of these ridges. But there is a very good reason for that. Now, what is the reason? There's a long argument going on, and I don't want to go into that too much. But the argument is that if the distance between the grooves of the perikimata reflects 7 to 9 days, and if you find that over here the perikimata come closer together, you can perhaps claim that it took longer to form a tooth in Homo sapiens than it did in the Neanderthal, where near the cervix there are fewer perikimata lines than in Homo sapiens. So Homo sapiens took longer to form this tooth than Neanderthal. Is it a big deal? For some people it is. And there is a lot of argument going on if this is the correct interpretation. The first argument, of course, is, are these actually 7 to 9 days, and how can you tell? Well, you can tell because there are 7 to 9 pairs of cross striations between each of the striae of Retzius, and we know that those are diurnal. And so let's now go to the diurnal structures. Cross striations. As I said before, these are diurnal manifestations, and they are corresponding with the imbrication lines of von Ebner in Dentin. Now, cross striations are again produced by a slightly heavier mineralized enamel part of the prism and less mineralized part of the prism. There is a pair, a darker, more mineralized piece, and a lesser mineralized, lighter structure, and that pair together is about 4 micrometers. It is along the length of the prism. If this is the prism, the cross striations go in this direction, at right angles to the course of the prism. Let's look at some of that. Okay, here's a beauty. This is the imbrication lines in Dentin. That's fine. This is the 20 micrometers apart thing. But here now, in a longitudinal section of enamel, or of a tooth rather, longitudinal section of a tooth, what you're seeing here are the prisms going horizontal, the striae of Retzius going in this direction, and now you're seeing the cross striations, light and dark, light and dark. In the ground section, the light cross striations, the light part of the cross striations is highly mineralized, the dark is less mineralized. It's just the opposite in electron microscopy. And now what you're seeing is that since the striae of Retzius are oblique relative to the course of the prisms, these cross striations, which become a little bit more defined in the case of the striae, tend to shift. So in one prism, which is a little bit further ahead in its development, the cross striations are also a little bit further outward. In the prisms that are shorter, that were not formed over the same length, the cross striations, of course, become more accentuated a little bit further back. So there is a shift in the cross striations as they become very outspoken in areas of the striae of Retzius, but it is interesting to realize all the cross striations line up. That is kind of cute. So, for those of you that want to learn stuff by heart, okay, without having any understanding, you can do that. In a longitudinal section of enamel, there is a set of prisms. They're not at right angles to the striae of Retzius, and similarly they are not at right angles to the cross striations in the striae, but they are at right angles to the cross striations inside the prism. Okay, yeah. In the dentin, well, these dark lines are these heavier imbrication lines which are 20 micrometers apart. If you have a very thin section, you could actually see 4 lines in between. Okay? Well, those are the actual imbrication lines, of the 4 micrometers apart.
What are the lines going in the other direction?
These? Yeah. Tubules. Dentin, tubules. Question?
So in the image on the left,
yeah,
the rods are aligned horizontally and the cross striations are vertical?
The cross striations are vertical, yes, at right angles to the prisms.
Is there a way to tell the difference? Because to me they look kind of like just a grid.
You have to look closely. No, I'm very serious. What you're seeing around the enamel prisms are the prism sheets, the light areas of the prism sheets. Okay, you really can tell. And when you see cross striations, and they really are separate little structures like this, they are inside the enamel prism. So, you know, there is a lot of possibility to picture that. By God, you really can tell. Okay, if you we can argue this a long time without bothering anybody else. So if you have a problem with it, reason it through, because it really, there is a logic to it, and it's really not hard. Okay. All right. Here.
What would the transverse section look like?
Excuse me. Transverse section. You would have the cross striations and the striae both at right angles to the prism. Okay. In the previous section, the cross striations were at an oblique angle to the striae of Retzius, but are at right angles to the prisms. Think it through. You can work it out. Okay. Here we have cross striations in transmission electron microscopy. Light areas here would be more mineralized in this case. Darker, no, that's incorrect. That is less mineralized. And the darker areas has more mineralized because you see more hydroxyapatite crystallites. The two together, 4 micrometers roughly, okay, that varies a little bit from here to there. And in the case of light microscopy here, you're seeing that the cross striations are found at right angles to the prism. And in the case of a scanning EM of prisms, you will see that the cross striations also correspond with bulges and constrictions, little grooves and little bulges. So the cross striations, in fact, also shape a little bit the outside of the surface of the enamel prism. Here they are, really pretty. In this case here, for some reason, the dark bands are lower mineral concentrations. This is SEM, so depending on whether you are transmission EM and SEM, you have different darknesses, and then don't worry about that. But in this case here, the dark bands are the lower mineral concentrations, the light bands are the heavier ones, and that pair together is 24 hours. Here again, what you're seeing, this is 24 hours, and you're seeing here the constriction in the area of the dark bands with the lower mineral and the widening in the area of the well-mineralized part of the enamel prism. So these are just various images to show you the cross striations and to make you aware that there is, in fact, a diurnal variation in the formation of enamel and in the mineralization thereof. Now, cross striations, in fact, continue in prismless enamel. So here you have an area where the prism stop roughly here. Kind of, this is the area. You see the cross striations here, but you see them continuing here in the prismless enamel as little lines. These look much more like the von Ebner lines than anything before. And here again, less mineralized, more mineralized, less mineralized, more mineralized. So this is these are cross striations in prismless enamel on the bottom picture. Okay, just once more, the relationship of the cross striations and the striae of Retzius in a longitudinal section. These are the prisms. The prisms are running all the way like this. Look closely. They are separated from each other by light lines. These are the prism sheets. Very different from this little stepwise situation of the Retzius striae, where you can't really make the error for the question that was asked. It really is not very easy to confuse enamel prism and a striae of Retzius. Trust me on that. Just work on it for a while and you see how easy it is. Okay, but so you see, there is this relationship, cross striations always perpendicular to the course of the prisms, both in longitudinal section and transverse section, but in a longitudinal section, the cross striations are at an angle to the striae of Retzius, as are the prisms.
Dr. Sondheim?
Yes.
You said the white line is the prism sheet?
Yes.
So, isn't it?
It shines. No. The white line, if it was true to function, the organic material would be dark, and in some sections it looks dark. But in this area here, because there is a peculiar reflection of the light, in this area here, the light line is in fact the organic sheet, which is reflecting light in all directions. Okay, it's
so with the white lines and vertical
lines,
Persian
sheet,
or is that only the horizontal
line? No, there are no vertical lines that are light.
Okay.
No.
So it doesn't completely surround each prism?
It surrounds it lengthwise, but the prism goes from here all the way out to here some point.
Okay.
So it's a tube.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay. All right, people, let's move along and now go to what's really a difficult part of this session. And that has to do with the curvilinear prism paths. There are three structures that we know about that are related to this curvilinear path, and this is really uniquely enamel, so let's begin with that. The first one that we are going to look at are tufts. Tufts are unmineralized parts of enamel prisms near the dentino-enamel junction. Now, please remember how the prisms were running. If these are different vertical levels, this is V1, V2, 3, you know, this would be the site of the DEJ, and at different vertical levels, prisms can run in these different kind of curvatures. So this is kind of wave-like way in which prisms run, and then after a while turns around and goes the opposite direction. We talked about the different paths of the secretory ameloblast. Now, in fact, remember that enamel is the mineralized results of these different pathways of the ameloblast. And so what you're seeing in enamel, if you see a series of prisms running in this direction, or if you see at a different level the series of prisms running in this direction, they reflect how the ameloblasts were moving when they were laying down those prisms. And what you find is that about the inner quarter to the inner third of enamel has these structures. These structures here, which are known as tufts. And they're called tufts because they look a little bit like blades of grass, that some of them are going one direction, some of them are going the other direction. It's kind of a peculiar term, but it's the one we use and we are happy with it. So the tufts are in fact areas where the enamel did not fully mineralize, and in general it tends to be along the lines of the prisms. So when you're looking at dentin, this being dentin, this is the DEJ, it is scalloped. Look at the number of enamel prisms that you find per scallop here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's roughly in a section. It's about 9 to 10 enamel prisms per one of those depressions or scallops of depression, just to give you an idea of the dimension of this thing. And now what you're finding is, very typically, at the point where you go from one depression of a scalloped DEJ to the next one, you find an area where there is a little protein sticking out. And alongside this protein, there is poor mineralization of the prisms that you find in that area. What you find in this area is a little bit of amelogenin, you find tuftalin. It's kind of an interesting mix of different proteins. And this is what you end up with. Tufts follow the course of the enamel prisms in the area, in the level where they are at. And so you can take a section through the enamel. This is a transverse section. And you focus it up and down. And at different levels of focus, the same section, and here you see this is the same section of a tooth, different levels of focus you can find in the prisms going in this direction, and therefore the blade of the tuft is going in this direction. And then in this same section, a different level, here you have the prisms going in this direction, and therefore also that blade of the tuft going in this direction. Tufts are found in transverse sections of teeth only. That's where you see their morphology. Because remember that the prisms are having that sinusoidal path in transverse planes of the tooth. They don't run sinusoidal paths in the vertical dimensions. And so, depending on how you're going, how you focus up and down, you can see these different orientations of the tufts as they correspond with the orientation of the prism at that particular plane of section. For those of you who worry a lot, there are two structures here. These are the spindles. Okay? So, that gives you an idea. The spindles are considerably smaller than tufts. Yeah? How big would an ameloblast be?
Yeah.
Well,
I'm curious, like, what the zoom
is. Think, how wide is a prism? 4 to 5 micrometers, right? Which is about the diameter of an ameloblast. So when you see a prism, this is a prism, this is the width of the prism, okay? And now you magnify it by 10, you get it, okay? Lots of little ameloblasts going in all directions. Yep. Okay, so these are tufts, mineralized structures at the DEJ, fanning out from the DEJ and following the orientation of the prisms. Spindles, very short extensions of dentinal tubules, they cross the DEJ and they don't give anything about the direction of the prisms. Okay, now here comes the beauty about tufts. How do tufts form and why do they form? We have an idea that tufts form very much like folds in jello. Have you ever made jello? Most of you have. You know, it's easy. Just throw the stuff in, the water in, wait a little while. And when the jello is beginning to set, not quite completely set, and you start to pull a little bit on it, it forms a series of folds. And when it does, that's when you have tufts. In the area where these folds are, where you get a little folding, that is an area where you get poor mineralization, and when you have poor mineralization in a tooth, in such areas, you end up with tufts. And what you actually find is that the tufts are not isolated to one spot, but they actually are running in vertical lines. You can see them here. Tufts are lined up in columns along the vertical axis of the tooth. This is here, if this is the vertical axis of the tooth, and you demineralize the enamel, what remains standing is the tuft protein, and that tuft protein forms like a little fringe that runs in a vertical direction. So tufts are not isolated, they are vertical structures that can run for very good distances along the long axis of the dentinoenamel junction. So in a tangential section, that this is, you can see these tufts kind of following each other up. They are literally lined up in rows. And in that sense, they are very similar to the neck structure. So this is the neck structure, and those are lamellae. Okay? Lamellae are also poorly mineralized parts of the enamel. Lamellae, in fact, are sheets of organic material running from the DEJ to the outer surface along vertical axes. Vertical axes. So lamellae always run vertically inside the enamel. Little sheets of organic material that run literally from the DEJ to the outside surface. If you make a transverse section through a tooth, this is a lamella. Okay? These are tufts. So the tufts are here, inner quarter to inner third. Lamella goes all the way out to the surface. Okay, here's the surface, here's the DEJ. That's a lamella. You see lamellae, because they are vertical structures, you see them best when you make a transverse section through a tooth, obviously. Now, this lamella looks like a giant tuft. And so there are, in fact, three different reasons why you can have lamellae. The first reason is that it's developmental. It is just a huge tuft, unmineralized matrix, and it just follows the alignment of the different prisms. But it can also be something else. It can, in fact, be a prenatal crack in the developing enamel that then subsequently became filled with organic material. And that organic material mostly comes from the enamel organ. So you get cells of the enamel organ kind of filling the stuff up, serum, a little bit of anything that you can that is floating around. And then finally, and that's something that we can do to ourselves, you can have postnatal cracks that become gradually filled with organic material from the oral cavity. So when you make a ground section of a tooth, you don't know which crack is what. And so you don't know what lamella you have. But you can tell a lamella, which is an organic sheath, from a crack that is produced as a result of grinding the section. And here it is beautifully shown. This is, again, a transverse section to the tooth. You see the tufts here. This is a tuft, this is a tuft. This is a lamella. This is a lamella. Okay? Here are some very large tufts. We call them tufts for now. So these large lamellae then are organically filled structures. And if you do a very careful demineralization, you can in fact have enough of the organic matrix remain standing so that you can actually see the lamella here and you can see all the little tufts here. These are all little tufts. But if you had a crack, there is no organic material there. This is a crack that you produce during the sectioning, and so that will not show in a preparation like that. So, lamellae, three types: poorly developed organic matrix that didn't mineralize. One, crack filled with prenatal gup, and a crack filled with postnatal gup. This is the third kind of crack. That is an artifactual crack. That one we don't call a lamella. The others we call lamellae. Okay, now we go to the final thing and then we'll get a long, big wait for a moment. Here we have Hunter-Schrager bands and gnarled enamel. Two features that are based on the same thing. Now we've talked about Hunter-Schrager bands before, and Hunter-Schrager bands were in fact first seen by this superior anatomist Hunter, who worked in the 18th century, and he wrote a beautiful book on the teeth. And he showed, when you cracked open a tooth, that if you look closely, you can see little lines going like this. Now, those lines that you're seeing in a cracked open tooth at this very low magnification are not prisms. They are what we now call the Hunter-Schrager bands. And he called them little fibers going from the DEJ outward to the surface. What we now know is that Hunter-Schrager bands, in fact, in a cracked tooth like this, are produced by ridges of enamel prisms going in one direction and valleys of enamel prisms going in the opposite direction. As you know, these are these curvy linear paths, one going in this direction, one going in this direction. And what you have is groups going in pretty much the same direction, but then after a while there's a shift and it just goes the other way. This kind of modeling that was done with a computer model shows that if you have a gradual reduction of the frequencies of curvilinear paths, you get this kind of pattern. This is a perfect pattern of Hunter-Schrager bands, okay? So in a cracked open tooth, the Hunter-Schrager bands are truly like fibers. Each of these is a fiber, some ridge that is standing out. But now what we do when we make a ground section, we of course grind it down. And when we grind it down, we get areas where the prisms are cut longitudinally, and there are areas where the prisms are cut in cross-section. And that produces, in light microscope, Hunter-Schrager bands. I've shown you this. I'm not going to bother with that right now. These are various types of models for Hunter-Schrager bands. But the ones that we are looking at are going to be seen in sections like this. And when you look fairly closely here, you may see some bending already at this level, because the cross-section prisms look slightly darker than the longitudinally section prisms. This is a Hunter-Schrager bend in ground section. And what you're seeing here are longitudinally sectioned and cross-sectioned groups of enamel prisms. And in other terminology, and you should know it because some people are going to use it, and you might find it on the board, so please make sure to know it. The longitudinally sectioned prisms bands are known as parazones, and the diazones are the cross-sectioned prisms in these kinds of groups. You're seeing here, this is one band kind of going like this, and here it is. Okay, so this is a diazone between those two red lines, and on either side of that you have a parazone, and here a diazone begins again. Okay, so that is the Hunter-Schrager band phenomenon. How do you see it in a longitudinal section? You don't see it in a cross-section. Now, how do you study Hunter-Schrager bands? You study them by turning the light off underneath your stage of your microscope and shining the light on top. And what you get then is different reflections. And the reflections for the Hunter-Schrager bands, the light reflections, are where you have the longitudinally sectioned prisms, while the dark areas, the dark bands, are where you have cross-sectioned prisms. Literally, those dark bands absorb the light, while the longitudinally cut prisms reflect the light back. So in incident light, that's what you're seeing. In polarized light, you see something else again. Here they have the longitudinally sectioned and the cross-sectioned, blue longitudinal, red in cross-section. Okay, how did we get there? Now we go just a couple more, but this is to learn to think about it in a way that we can handle it. Some years ago, you know, people like us are crazy. We like to talk about enamel, and we can go to a meeting and we talk for 3 days about Hunter-Schrager bands. I mean, we do stupid things like that. We really enjoy it. And some years ago, in the 90s now, we went to a meeting, and there were lots of people with lots of different ideas about Hunter-Schrager bands. And I came with the idea of the human mammalian condition. There are other people working on rodents, and rodents admittedly do things differently, and they have very peculiar Hunter-Schrager bands. But in the case of humans, we can make this particular model, which has become fondly known as the orange squeeze model. But what you essentially have is as follows. Look at this surface right here, formed by Y and O, and this is the Z, X, so Y, O, Z is one plane, that is the DEJ, and then you have another plane formed by Y, O, X, which would be a longitudinally sectioned surface of a tooth. And now, in this tooth, you have selected three different vertical levels that are represented by A, B, and C. Okay? And what you now do is you do a time study of amelogenesis. And you say, okay, this is the more occlusal location, that first one. And so at T sub 0, ameloblast 1 starts to move, and it goes in this direction here. And it continues on until this point here when it reaches time sub 1. At time sub 1, you now have all the ameloblasts in the middle that, of these two planes that have now started to work. And now this ameloblast begins to work, and it starts to move, and it starts to move in this direction. But the interesting thing is that the ameloblast in the first plane is also moving in this direction. And so they're really moving parallel. That's the beauty of it. But because they started at different times, they seem to be out of phase. They are not in phase if you look at the final end result. But at T sub 2, we are both at this point right here, and now we have the third ameloblast coming in over here, and it starts to move in this direction, which is, again, parallel to this and parallel to that. And so what I'm saying is, think about an enamel organ and think about the ameloblast in the enamel organ. What you cannot really do is one ameloblast moving in that direction, one ameloblast moving in totally opposite direction at the same time without tearing that enamel organ apart. What you can do, you can have an enamel organ that is moving in one direction with all the ameloblasts moving in one direction and then moving out in the next direction and further and further. Of course, the closer you are to the DEJ, the more movement you can afford yourself, you have more space. The further out you go, the fewer motions are possible. And what we do find is that the greatest curvatures are found generally near the DEJ. But the concept that all of the ameloblasts are moving parallel at the same time is an attractive one. And if you think about the enamel organ just moving back and forth, slightly twisting back and forth as the ameloblasts are laying down the enamel, may produce this particular pattern, this curvilinear path. So that is my contribution to that particular discussion. Now, if these are the Hunter-Schrager bands in the longitudinal section, if you now think about the area of the cusp where everything gets more tightly wound, what you now can have, again, is the orange squeeze model in function. You can have alternating bands, but they now begin to look more and more concentric as you move back and forth with the ameloblast layer. And so in the area of the cusps, if you make a cross-section through an area of the cusp, you see the Hunter-Schrager bands, but you see them in concentric circles. And if you now were to make a cut through here, you see a holy mess. What you're seeing here is, these are Hunter-Schrager bands. You can see them nicely, dark and light bands alternating. But in this area here, there is little patches of light and dark. And what you have is literally areas of cross-section prisms, areas of longitudinal section prisms, and they're all meshed together. It is like the gnarled wood of a tree at where you have a branch. And that's why it's called gnarled enamel. Gnarled enamel is literally the tightly wound Hunter-Schrager band phenomenon cut at a vertical plane. That is the best way to say it. This is the diagram that I want you to look at, get the idea, and now when you cut through it, you get the gnarled enamel here. You see it again here. Very funny looking enamel, going in all directions. One reason why you don't want to put the edge of any restoration right through the gnarled enamel, because you get little pieces of enamel are going to break off, and that's not a good idea. Okay, this is a lot of stuff. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll go on to the enamel.